Well, welcome back, everyone. This is Eric Ellefson. Today, I'm with Professor of Education at Dort College, David Mulder, where he teaches future teachers. There's few people in this world I love following on Twitter more than David, just for a simple fact that he loves his profession, he loves teaching, and he loves education. If you haven't read his blog, I Teach and I Learn, I'll connect that with this podcast so that you can read it. It's one of the best blogs that I get to read on a regular basis. David's interests include educational technology, online learning, adolescent education, science education, social networks for professional learning, and teaching Christianly. And there's really no one I know that is more connected in the social media world. And maybe that's a question for later. But my first question has to be, and it was the way that I got introduced to David, was I read his blog, No More Crappy Homework. So David, tell me what was the impetus for writing that? It's been about 3 years now. I love the phrase. I love the idea. Yeah. It caught my attention. But you know, I've been lamenting the fact that homework is a soul crusher for our profession, for learning, and for kids. And you began writing that, you know, 3 years ago, and we've talked about it ongoing ever since.
You're right, right. Thanks for having me, by the way. Yeah, this is kind of a passion area for me, and it's been growing for a number of years. Before I started teaching in higher ed, I was a middle school science teacher for a lot of years. And this was in my background. The longer I taught, the less homework I gave, because I started to realize that it wasn't doing what I thought it was doing. And I honestly, that phrase, no more crappy homework, that I gave the title of that original blog post, comes from just my desire that if I'm going to assign work for my students to do, it better be valuable, because kids today are busy. They're busy in school, but they're busy outside of school too. And this feels like one of those areas where it's really easy, I think, for us as teachers to start encroaching in on home life. And yeah, now that I'm a parent of middle schoolers and high schoolers too, I'm all the more aware, not that you can't be a great teacher if you're not a parent. I don't mean to suggest that at all. But when I had kids of my own at this grade level, I just started to become more and more aware of the kinds of work that I had assigned as a teacher and how troubling it was for me when I just came to realize the really shoddy quality of a lot of the things that I'd asked students to do over the years.
So this is such a personal thing for teachers, and I found so much of myself, man, I made my kids work so hard and I was so proud of it. And then I got to the place where I realized, you know what, 90% of it was a complete and utter waste of their time. And even of my time when I graded it, because I lamented the fact that I had this pile of papers that was like, really, it's kind of meaningless.
Right, exactly.
Like, so for you, like when you look back, and then even as you work with teachers now, like what when you look back, it's like, I would just get rid of all of this stuff and this nonsense. What are some examples of that?
Sure. So one of the things that I became aware of, and like I say, the longer I taught, the less homework I was assigning, because I would assign kids to read out of a textbook, for instance. And I'm not opposed to textbooks, and I'm sure not opposed to kids reading. They should read. And in the content areas too, they should read. But I was always assigning the comprehension questions, I'm putting this in air quotes here as I say it, right? Those comprehension questions at the end of a chapter. And what I really started to realize was they don't actually assess kids' comprehension. They are a way of holding kids accountable for doing something, but accountability and learning are not really the same thing. And so even in that, I stopped assigning comprehension questions. I just assigned them to actually read things. And then I still had this fear that they weren't going to do the reading. So I came across a couple content area reading strategies, for instance. One of them that I love is just called Clink Clunk. And clink means I got it, and clunk means I have a question about this. And so what I would give the kids was just a half sheet of paper where I would scribble down the main topics in the reading and just had a little checkbox next to each of those topics. And as they were reading, I said, all you got to do is have your brain turned on while you're reading. And if at the end of reading this section, you say, yeah, I think I got it, check clink. And if you say, I have a question about this, then check clunk and just jot down the question. Maybe the question is, I don't know what this means and I'm confused. Can you please explain it to me? And that's fine. Or maybe it's something specific about the reading. So that's just a silly little way of doing this. And I've done this with middle schoolers, but now it's actually shown up in my college classes too, where I have students, I assign them to read the text, And, you know, is it possible the kids are just going through randomly checking clink and clunk? Yep, it's possible. I fully recognize that. But you can usually tell once you start having some conversation with them about what they've read in preparation for class. And it's more, I just want them to spend a little time thinking about it, actually doing the reading and not just skimming for an answer.
And so you even mentioned in there the accountability for learning.
Yeah.
Right? Because so often we hear, like, if I don't assign it and I don't give a grade for it, they're not going to do it and therefore they're not going to learn it. How have you discovered that that's just a complete and utter fallacy?
Oh, and it is. It is. It's a myth, right? I'm getting a little passionate about this. Right? The problem is, I think a lot of us as teachers, we want to develop responsibility in our students. We want them to be responsible. Of course we do. We're not trying to make students be irresponsible. We want them to be responsible. But I hear that so often from teachers that, well, I'm giving them homework because it's teaching them responsibility. I think if you want kids to learn to be responsible, just give them things to be responsible for, like authentic responsibility. Doing something because you say they have to do it does not actually mean they're responsible. That means they're compliant. You've said you have to do this, and so the kids do it. And now you say, oh, see, now they're responsible. That's not responsible. That's compliant. And I don't want kids to be non-compliant. I want them to be compliant. Of course we do. But this is one of those places where I think the reason that we give is fallacious. I don't think that's really what we mean. We want them to comply with what we're trying to get them to do.
And so, you know, as I even think about that, because, you know, you've written about in the research, and maybe this will kind of come to, you know, a final question eventually, but in this process, like, how does it free you up when you take away this kind of workload and these assignments and these piddly-dink things that we just add on to kids that they go home and they irritate their parents with because they got to do it, you know, sometime and they got to figure out when and all that. Like, how does it free up when you decrease this and when you shrink this way down and when you take a different view of homework and of student learning, how does it free you up or how has it freed you up to be a much more effective teacher?
Well, I really appreciate that question because I think there's a couple things happening in tandem. I'm not opposed to homework on principle, but I'm opposed to crappy homework. And so that's, I think, a distinguishing point here. If I'm going to ask students to do something outside of class, it better be really valuable work. It better be practice that is absolutely essential for them. And to say that, then it's got to be targeted. It has to be practice at just what they need, the particular skills they need to work on, a particular knowledge base, or it better be preparation for something that they're going to do in class tomorrow. The reading that I've done about homework, what makes homework effective, suggests that the longer students spend working on homework, the fewer benefits there are. There's actually a pretty strong correlation to that. The more time they spend on it, it's the law of diminishing returns. The longer they spend at it, the less they get out of it. So better to have kids do a small, very tightly focused practice session for some particular thing, or a small, tightly focused preparation for the next day's work that they'll actually do, and they'll get the benefit from that. And so it ends up being, you have to kind of tighten up your approach as a teacher. That means I also need to make the most of my class time with students and use that time when we're actually there together to its full benefit. And then that means I maybe don't have to expect so much from homework.
So, and then add in there the question, you remember the days we'd collect all this homework and then you'd slap like a sticker on it or a good job or, you know, just a 5 out of 5 because you did it. Like, talk about how that even demotivates or even in some of your writing, you've talked about assessing, you know, different things and how actually really quality assessment actually produces more learning rather than some of these, you know, old-fashioned thumbs up, good job.
Right, right. So one of the questions that I hear from students too is when we think about grades and when we think about what students are doing, Rick Wormley is someone who you definitely should follow on Twitter if you're not already following him. And he's talked about that, the difference between what really good formative assessment is and summative assessment, so we call summative assessment. And he talks about it in terms of formative assessment is about feedback. And feedback helps you grow if it's timely and specific and actionable. And so it's got to be a quick turnaround, make it timely. It's got to be specific. Talk about the specific strengths and weaknesses of the work. You know, what was good? Good job isn't specific, but what was good about it, or what areas need to be worked on? And actionable. This is the tricky one, because a lot of us as teachers are really good at just putting a thumbs up or a sticker on something. To actually require students to do the hard work of revising based on feedback and making a difference, then, that they have the opportunity and it becomes an expectation that they will have to rework it. And then Rick says, you know, summative assessment, he says we really should just call it judgment, because that's really what it is. At that point, you know, we do, as teachers, we need to be able to judge the quality of our students' work. We should, but let's not kid ourselves that that's feedback at that point. Then it's just, here's how you did. And so to put more emphasis on the formative aspects and maybe de-emphasize the summative aspects of assessment and evaluation.
So that gets into maybe one last question, you know, big picture question, as we put into you know, all of these things and no more crappy homework, and you're a dad and you're a professor and you're all these things. So maybe flip it. You know, what would be the valuable, the worthwhile approach? Give me the big picture of, like, this is what I see works for student learning, creates independence and an interest in learning, and then helps students move forward as they get closer to, you might say, those judgment days or those more, you know, those summative assessments where, you know what, it is, we want to know what you can do and what you know. Like, give me the big picture of, like, what you desire your student teachers or your, you know, teachers to be able to do when they walk back into, when they walk into those classrooms.
So one of the big things that I think a lot about with this comes back to John Hattie's research. If you're familiar with John Hattie, and he did this study on visible learning, and he looks at like 140 different things that teachers do. Not all of them are school-related things. There are some home things too, but a lot of it is things teachers do. And homework does show up on the list, but it's something like 88th place out of these 140 things, right? It's way down the list. And the things that he's got towards the top of the list are things like tapping into students' creativity, not labeling our students and putting them in a box, incorporating play in the classroom, having really high quality professional development for teachers where they have to collaborate with their colleagues, and things like reducing student anxiety. Okay, and he's got lists. I mean, there's so many things on the list. And a lot of these are basically philosophical differences, right? And thinking about our work as professional educators in such a way that we think of ourselves as experts in content, experts in pedagogy, but also creative designers. And instead of just slavishly following whatever a teacher's guide says, recognize that the professionalism that we have says, okay, I'm going to use that as a guide. Yeah, it's a guide, but I'm the professional. And I'm going to take a creative approach to what happens in my classroom. I'm going to really get to know the unique individuals that I'm teaching and make a difference in their lives. That's what I hope for my students too.
That's really cool. All right, Dave. I know I said last question, but I always follow up with something last. You're one of the most, and I'm sure you hear it all the time with the social media stuff, and that's really how you and I developed a relationship. Right. And, you know, we got to meet in Iowa, you know, a couple of years back. But, you know, really the way we stay in touch is the professional learning network that, right, you know, that you've allowed me to enter into, you know, that you've been a part of, but then that we get connected with. How is, you know, just on a side note with, you know, with all of this, how has that professional learning network on Twitter in particular been influential in your development professionally, but then also your engagement in the larger profession?
Oh, sure. Oh, this is so funny that you asked that, right? So I served as a technology coordinator for a K-8 school for a few years, and I joined Twitter back in like 2008 because this is one of those places where I felt like, man, I'm going to have teachers asking me about this. I better know what this thing is. And so I joined a bunch of different, I started using all these different tools. Twitter's one of the ones that stuck for me because the more I got involved, and you said it, professional learning network, that's really what Twitter has become for me. I follow about 1,000 mostly educators on Twitter. And so it's a curated list of people who have things to say that they're sharing online. They're retweeting other people. They're sharing resources, sharing stories out of their classrooms. And yeah, in short bursts, you know, 140 or 280 characters at a time, that's all you get. But you start to get to know people. You get a window into their classroom. You get to read over their shoulder the great things that they're reading and thinking about. And you start to build very real relationships. And in a strange way, I have friends all across North America and around the world, some of whom I've met up face-to-face like you, and some who I've never actually sat down in the same room with. But we're learning together. And to me, that's the benefit of getting involved. And Twitter is great because you can use it in so many different ways. If you just join Twitter and follow people, even that, it's a curated list of people who you find interesting in education. And there are hundreds of thousands of teachers on Twitter. So just to know that there's a lot of people out there. As you start feeling more comfortable, you get involved in the conversation. Pretty soon, you're the one who's out there sharing things. I started blogging a few years ago, like you had mentioned. And I thought, you know, since I'm a professor, people will care what I have to say. Nobody cares what you have to say, right? So you start sharing things out there. After a while, you get to know people. And people start regularly reading your blog because I tweet out the link. And then we start having conversations about it. And some of those spill over into real life conversations where when we meet up at a conference or something, and we already know each other because we've been talking online for a long time. So I highly recommend it.
Yeah. And Dave, I appreciate this time with me. And it has been, I mean, that Twitter and that professional learning network has been so incredibly beneficial to me as a professional in my growth and my development, and even just thinking outside the box.
Yeah. Same.
And that wisdom of just understanding, because we can get so busy in our world in education that if we are not connected to the larger world in some ways, and Twitter provides that great opportunity and social media in other ways, but definitely Twitter in particular, that we get focused and we just end up doing all the same stuff that we've always done.
Right.
So thanks, Dave, for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.